Chatting It Up Midweek Wednesday style, September 4th, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where I open the show with a word that some Democrats in the General Assembly might finally be getting the message on high electric bills. We welcome Ira Chalif, author of To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader, while CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum stopped by to chat about the Justice Department's legal action this week against Hamas. All right, so maybe, just maybe, now we can hope against hope, cross our fingers, cross our toes, whatever. Maybe they're starting to get it. Maybe the Democratic side of the state legislature, maybe the governor, just maybe, hoping against hope that they're starting to get it, because you people are keeping up the pressure, and we're not going to let this fall off the radar. What are we talking about again? Well, again, I start another show because all you have to do is mention electric bill and people get cartoon eyes. You know what I mean? Bing! I was talking about this again earlier with a couple, three people here at the radio station. And finally now, despite every effort from Martin Looney and Bob Duff and Matt Ritter to say, this is not a big deal, this is just it's a Republican campaign tactic because Trump. When you have nothing else, you go to batting practice and you slam the because Trump fastballs 420 feet in the second deck. This story, again, by the outstanding writer Paul Hughes in the Waterbury Republican-American. He begins, quote, whenever State Rep. Ron Napoli campaigns in Waterbury, the Democrat hears from voters amped up over their electric bills. See, folks, and I'll get back to the story in a minute. This is me talking now. Nobody wants to hear, and I keep saying this over and over again, and if you people in the leadership in Hartford are listening, hello, test 1, 2, 3. Hello? Nobody cares for your explanation of where it came from. Nobody cares. Officer, the bullets came through my window over there. Well, let me figure out, the reasons why they might have come through. I don't care what the reasons are. Go get who did it. We can parse all the reasons later on. But I think now, finally, with you folks keeping up the pressure, signing petitions, calling, being respectful and adult-like when you call a legislator's office, when you write an email to your state rep, Republican or Democrat, House or Senate, they're starting to understand it. They're starting to hear this. You cannot let up on the pressure now. What people want is relief now. The story continues from some of the highest costs for electricity in the continental United States. Well, you know, Paul, this is because I don't want to hear because. I want adults to face the press, to face the reporters in this state together. And say, yes, people are PO'd, we hear that, so here's what we are going to do or what we may try and do. Again, that's all. Napoli said Tuesday he's disappointed that the Public Utility Regulatory Authority declined to deliver it last week. And he was talking about any sort of relief from the last round of increases. He said, quote, it's an affordability issue. It is certainly on voters' minds. It's something we have to address. Now, understand that. Here is a state legislator, and I'll try to get Rep. Napoli on the show here, hopefully by the end of the week here, if not early next week. Here is a legislator from the Democratic side of the aisle, from a decidedly blue city, but not too far away from red areas, outside Waterbury, if you go to Watertown and areas around there. That's a little bit of a code there. That's a little bit of a smoke signal. It's an affordability issue. It is certainly on voters' minds. It's something we have to address. That sounds, now I can't speak for exactly what Representative Napoli is saying here, but if you kind of read between the lines here, that might sort of kind of be a little hello to his leadership there. It's an affordability issue. It is certainly on voters' minds. It's something we have to address. And again, some of these state house districts, maybe not so much the Senate districts because they're bigger, they have more people in them, but some of these state house districts can be flipped one way or the other with a couple of hundred votes. And again, there is the realization here, and there has to be, and maybe the governor is starting to get it. I'll get to that part of the story in a moment. But it's the realization that maybe, just maybe, they're starting to understand that people at least want an acknowledgement together in a bipartisan way, or it may cost some people their House or Senate seats. Napoli said he continues to hope the legislature and Governor Ned Lamont will be able to take some actions to provide rate relief in the coming months. Now, that's interesting considering Representative Napoli's leader, Matt Ritter, is dismissive about this, and he and the other Democrats in Hartford are blaming this on the Republicans, worried about how Donald Trump is going to do in Connecticut. I have news for the Democratic leadership in Hartford. Donald Trump ain't going to win Connecticut. Mr. Trump is likely to get his rear end handed to him in Connecticut, all right? Can we move beyond that now? This ain't about Trump. It's about a lot of PO'd Republicans and Democrats. Democrats, liberals, unaffiliateds, independents, Republicans, conservatives, everybody pays an electric bill, unless you're off the grid and you have your own windmill, which I guess there aren't too many, or you have your little portable nuclear plant out in the backyard by the swimming pool. He said he continues to hope the legislature and Governor Lamont will take some actions to provide rate relief in the coming months rather than wait until after the November elections. You know what that sounds like? Again, that sounds like Mr. Napoli saying, there are people that are mad out here. Now, during a stopover yesterday, Tuesday, in Waterbury, the governor was in town there for the grand opening of the Linden Place Apartments. The governor confirmed he invited the four top Democratic and Republican leaders and the bipartisan leadership of the Energy and Technology Committee to meet with him today to discuss energy policy and electricity costs. Now, judging the governor from afar, and I've only met him once. It was years ago when he was running for the Senate. Nice enough guy. We had a nice chat out by his car. He had just appeared at a college to do a kind of a prep, rah-rah speech. Ned Lamont's not dumb. He's not. He didn't get to have the family wealth that he attained by being stupid. And my instinct tells me that he doesn't care about the politics here. See, the Democratic legislative leaders do. Matt Ritter, Martin Looney, Bob Duff, all of Mr. Rojas, all those people, they're looking at this as a we're not going to budge thing. I hope, and as soon as I see anything about that meeting, either today or tomorrow, I'll let you know. But I would think that the governor will look everybody in the eye there and say, look, we have got to do something about this. And if the governor is the kind of leader I think he is, he'll tell all the folks there at this little meeting, if in fact they do have it. Now, he invited the leaders, doesn't mean that he ordered them there. And if you're not going to meet at the request of the governor, that's a pretty big brass set of uglioni you got, but that's another discussion for another time and place. I would think he would look all four of them in the eye, and whomever they bring there, and say, hey, you know, let's dial back the partisanship here, which is the adult thing to do, and say, hey, let's at least get together for a few days, even if it's to glad hand everybody and backslap everybody and say, hey, we're going to set up this and that, and we'll at least take a look at this. Lamont once again acknowledged the public outrage over a big jump in bills for Eversource customers in particular following the rate changes that took place effective July 1, but he pointed to increases in usage during the hot and humid summer as the main culprit. The governor said, quote, first of all, 90% of the increase was related to the hottest July in recorded history in the state of Connecticut. Well, that's good, but see, again, this is where, much as I like the guy, the governor doesn't get it. You can't say, well, 90% of that increase, and most people would say, yeah, but you know what, governor, the other 10% are really ticking me off here. And again, this isn't hard. And maybe, depending upon what Representative Napoli was saying and maybe what the governor is saying, maybe you folks are starting to kind of, you know, hit him in the hammerhead here and get them to understand. So again, I am urging you. And by the way, if you have called or written to a state house or state legislative office or state senate member, what have they said to you? I'd love to hear that. Now, again, if you call or write an email being courteous and nice, you'll probably get some nice response, I would think. But has this episode with the electric bills and the statewide anger about this, has this episode driven you to actually pay attention and or contact Hartford, the kind of thing you've never done before? Because I can bet 98, 99% of people, no fault of theirs, but I'm sure the vast majority of people out there have never even taken the time. Oh, how do I do it? I don't know. This is good. We're going to get a benefit out of this. We're going to get a benefit out of this because people are upset. I don't blame them. Lamont said he agreed with Marissa Gillette in April when she argued the cost of the moratorium and the Millstone contract should be recouped over 22 months instead of a 10-month period. Well, he said that made pretty good sense, but that's not what happened. So again, here we are. Maybe, I don't know, I look over there, there's a little crack in the foundation. Maybe people are finally starting to get this. If you're hearing from a Democrat House member in a state's major city, and he's saying like it's a big election year issue, he's trying to send a smoke signal there. We have all been exposed to the word tyrant, right? T-Y-R-A-N-T. This guy's a tyrant. She's a tyrant. Oh, he's a tyrant at work. Or, man, I hated that teacher. She acted like a tyrant. There are tyrants in government as well from thousands of years ago, some would say up to the present day. So what's the deal with that? Now, some tyrants come to power by force. Others, though, appeal to a lot of wide-ranging people. Our next guest is the founder and former head of Executive Coaching and Consulting Associates, Chairman Emeritus of the Congressional Management Foundation in D.C. That's a nonpartisan group helping elected officials on both sides of the aisle. His latest book, To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break, B-R-A-K-E, to make or break a toxic leader. Ira Chalif is the guest. Ira, good afternoon. It's Paul in Connecticut. Good. How are you?
Paul in Connecticut. How are you?
Fine, Paul. Good to hear you.
So, Ira, the genesis of this book, tell us about it.
Yes. Well, the real genesis is that I grew up in a family where my maternal grandmother lost her family in the Holocaust. And at a very young age, I asked, how does that happen? Why do people follow leaders who become so tyrannical? Well, about 40 years ago, I came to Washington, D.C., seeing if I could make some kind of a difference in government. I found this interesting niche working with congressional offices, and I saw how some of the younger staff in their 20s or 30s would become quite influential with their 40, 50, 60-year-old members of Congress. And I realized that the role of follower, which we don't particularly think very much of in our culture, everyone's supposed to be a leader, but the role of follower really makes a difference and can make a political leader shine or can make them not look so very good. So I began to write about this. I was very fortunate. My books went everywhere I hoped they would, military, police, government agencies. And a lot of people saw that the role of follower was a much more active and influential role than they had perceived. But I hadn't yet explored what really drove me, which was what about when a political tyrant is emerging? When do we have an opportunity to interfere with that trajectory before they become a full-blown tyrant where it's too late? That's what this book is about. How do we stop a tyrant before they become that tyrant?
So you're saying that the young followers give tyrants what, Ira? Oxygen, adrenaline, the fuel they need to attain their power?
Well, that's one of the things they give them. They give them good information, good research, good strategy. If they're very good, they also give them wise counsel, saying, Congressman, that's really going a bridge too far. That's not going to serve you well. It's not going to serve your constituents well. And even though the political leader might initially resist that, if the follower, if the staffer has good political savvy, which includes good communication skills, they know how to get their leader to pay attention, and they can make that leader look better and be more successful. However, they can also make a bad leader more powerful, and that's where we have to differentiate between which leaders do we want to give that oxygen to and which should we really not.
You know, Ira, it's interesting. I'm hearing something I've never heard before in my 30 or 40 years of covering politics, the notion that underlings, if you will, or staffers have a big role in creating tyrannical behavior. Have you gotten pushback from that by people who've read your books or groups you've spoken to? Yes or no?
No. Let me step back just a bit from there. You still with me, Paul?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. Let me step back just a moment. See, the premise here is that followers can make a leader look good or make them look bad. Mm-hmm. There are three kinds of followers in my discussion of this. One is the conformist follower. Whatever you tell them to do, they do it. Okay, no harm, no foul. They just get things done. The next is a colluder. They are someone who has a vested interest in working with a leader whose agenda may have a dark side to it, mm-hmm. and they become the problem. The third type of follower is what I call the courageous follower, one who will say to the leader, look, none of us are perfect. I want to support your better angels, but I also want to tell you where you may be crossing a line into some place we should not be going. And if they do that well, they can actually make that leader serve their constituents better than they otherwise would have.
Interesting, very interesting theory. A lot of people would look at former President Trump, Ira, who is, of course, running for re-election, and say, well, the guy's a garden variety tyrant. Not wanting to get overly political here, but what were your thoughts beyond that?
Well, here's where I come from. As you said in the introduction, I worked for 40 years in Washington, D.C. in a nonpartisan capacity. That means that I didn't try to tell anyone who they should vote for. What I did do is try to get whoever they had elected to serve them better. Mm. Now, that's where I'm coming from with this book. I'm not trying to tell half of America, no, you're wrong, you should vote for the other half. But what I am saying is that stay awake, stay alert, because if the leader you're supporting is starting to make you uncomfortable, you're not sure, are they crossing a line? And I don't care on which side of the aisle it is. Sure. History is full of tyrants on, you know, the left and the right. Nobody has a monopoly on this. If you are seeing that your leader, the one you'd prefer to see in office, is crossing certain lines, then you've got to make a decision. Either you have to figure out how to pull them back from that trajectory, or maybe it's time to cut them loose and go find someone else you can support.
Finally, Ira, in the notion of the present day, is the American electorate as discerning and as intelligent and as thoughtful to try and avoid tyrants, or the world electorate for that matter? Basically, are people smart enough to realize this or not, or do emotions and feelings get in the way too often?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head, Paul. It's two things. It's emotions and feelings, but it's also their perception of the context of the times. In other words, if people feel they are, for example, economically distressed and they feel the people in power haven't helped them, then they're going to be more prone to listen to the other guy who says, well, I've got the solutions. The place we have to be careful about, though, is that when someone offers easy solutions, no problem, first day in office, I'll have it solved. They're really probably not having the sophistication, the reality, the strategy, the coalitions to really make a difference. They're selling us too much of a bill of goods. So we have to be discerning. And Paul, the thing that I tell people the most these days is, in all dictatorships, the government tells you to only listen to their channel, their message.
Yep.
Now, what we're doing is we're doing it to ourselves. We're only listening to one side of the aisle. And I'm saying, wake up every morning and listen to two or three different viewpoints. And then you start to make your decision about where can you place your confidence, your trust in who we elect to run this beautiful country.
Excellent thought to finish up on. Name of the book, To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. And Ira Chalif has been the guest and the author. Ira, thank you. Great thoughts. Very enjoyable. Good luck with the book, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Ira Chalif there, To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. Back here on Connecticut Today on this midweek Wednesday. In the news, the DOJ going after leaders of Hamas. How does the U.S. Justice Department do that legally? Joining us right now, CBS News radio analyst Thane Rosenbaum to try and peel the layers back on this. Hey, Thane, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime for you, Paul, you know that.
Thanks, appreciate it. How does this work? The average person may say, hey, this is the U.S. Justice Department going after an alleged terrorist leader. How does that work legally?
Well, it does and it doesn't, right? I mean, you have to have jurisdiction over the body. And that body right now, in name of Sinwar, who's the military leader of Hamas in Gaza, is in some tunnel. Now, we know in the case of Osama bin Laden that SEAL Team 6 went and got him and killed him. We didn't bring him back for a trial. We could have, but we didn't even bother with it. Mm-hmm. They just killed him. Did the United States have jurisdiction to go into Pakistan to do that? No. And in fact, the Pakistanis didn't like it. But terrorism is a crime in the United States. And giving material support to terrorists is a crime. And he is clearly the architect of the 10/7 massacre. They also indicted another four of his henchmen, three of whom are dead. The Israelis have said those are dead. So it does make you think that some of this is symbolic, right? Unless Joe Biden orders SEAL team or special forces team to go get him, we have no way to bring him back into this courthouse. The Israelis have been hunting him through tunnels for 10 months. They've been close to him. Occasionally, apparently, they found him, but he was standing next to a bunch of civilian hostages, mm-hmm. so they couldn't take any action against him. The Israelis will definitely get him. He most recently issued a statement that part of any ceasefire agreement requires that he remain alive. So the guy is also a coward. He doesn't want to die like a martyr in the way that he is willing to martyr all of his own citizens. But these are crimes. He killed an American citizen. Hirsch Goldberg was an American citizen. He was just assassinated 6 days ago. So these are crimes. There's jurisdictional problems of getting the body, personal jurisdiction. How do you get him to sit in trial? And two, given what we did with bin Laden, do we need to? Let me give you another one. You may remember Anwar al-Awlaki mm-hmm. was an American citizen from Arizona.
Yes.
Who went to Yemen and started on his own TV channel preaching terrorist Islamic recruitment videos. And he radicalized lots of people, including Major Hassan in the American government, who ended up killing people at Fort Hood, his own fellow American soldiers. He was a Muslim American, but he was radicalized by al-Awlaki. President Obama ordered a drone hit on him in Yemen. Awlaki's father in Arizona is going, are you kidding?
I remember this. Yes.
My boy is an American citizen. He went to public school in Arizona. Who are you to do something like this? And no one has said anything about it. he deserves to die. But, you know, Awlaki's father is still alive and is still screaming about how you did it. So the answer to this question is it's complicated, but it's not legalistic, right? Because obviously when we want to kill someone, we do.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it looks a little ceremonial, symbolic, because some of the other co-defendants aren't even alive.
Does any of this thing fly in the face of international law, international criminal law, stuff that's recognized worldwide? Yes or no?
Unless you have an extradition treaty with another government, Gaza is not a government. They could have been. Nothing could have stopped them from declaring statehood. They just want to kill Jews. So that's why they've never done anything other than, again, bring in bombs and tunnel equipment. But they're not a country. So we don't have an extradition deal with them. This is truly the wild, wild west. You know, you're mm-hmm. trying to get someone who is a terrorist, who is already an international criminal. In terms of international law, I can assure you, right, if we did what we did with bin Laden, a lot of countries would be upset. And you'd go, what? Why does anyone care about this guy, Sinwar? He's the architect of October 7th.
Mm.
You know, people all of a sudden would all become international lawyers, and they would all say, we didn't have a legal right to kill him.
Yeah.
So it's a murky area, Paul.
Yeah, all the Google University lawyers. Yes. Thane Rosenbaum. You like that? Thane Rosenbaum on the DOJ Hamas charges. Thane, legal analyst for CBS News. Thane, thanks for chatting. I do appreciate the time. We'll chat down the road. Thank you so much.
Anytime, buddy. Thank you.